Mother Nature, Mother Nature, she's gonna get you. Yeah, she's gonna get you. Mother Nature, she's grown to hate you, and she's gonna get you. Gonna get you, you betcha.
That's almost 52 years so far. The world has become a worse and worse place. Every year we have polluted more water than the year before.
Hey, welcome to Nature Bats Last, the Progressive Radio Network. It's NBL on PRN.FM. This February 23rd, 2016 edition, episode 78 of Nature Bats Last, comes to you live from the Mud Hut in southern New Mexico. Our thanks to Afrozin for his theme song contribution. You can find more of his work, of course, on SoundCloud.com. Today is about the listeners, and we hope some people can call in and participate in the show. We have some topics we can cover, and you're welcome to bring up some other topics as well, and just kind of shoot the breeze and see what's going on and hear from you. So if you want to do that, please call us at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. But first, we've done this a few times during the year, and we want to do it at least one more time here. It's a statement from Afrozin regarding the theme song he wrote for Guy's work and that we use on the show.
The much-loved and much-hated theme song.
Right. Apparently, the dialogue about this song just won't go away. It seems about once a month we get somebody pleading with us to take it off.
Yeah, take it off the air. It was written specifically for my work.
Yeah, well,
it's the song is called Nature Bats Last.
Right, unless we get a song that has the same title and is better, catchier, which I doubt.
Hey, we're open to anything happening.
Right.
Except miracles and astrology.
So this is what Afrozin wrote in regarding his song and how his thoughts have changed.
And when did he write this?
I think I did it last March is when the first time I read it on the air.
Okay, so it's been a year since he sent this to us.
Right.
It's something of a disclaimer with respect to the lyrics.
Correct. And who knows? I mean, maybe he's even, he can send us something else because this is a journey we're all on. So
you know, the flip side of this song, it has a B side.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
And it's awesome, too.
Yeah.
I can't remember the title of it, but if you play Nature Bats Last on SoundCloud by Afrozin, it will go automatically to the next song.
Right. We've played that song on the air.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
It is. As are most Doomer songs.
Of course.
The song we got a couple weeks ago was really good, too, from John. So.
Yeah.
All right. In my journey through the DABDA stages of grieving regarding my understanding and expectation of what is to come in terms of anthropomorphic climate change, this song expresses my time in the first A, anger. With time and reflection, I've made it through to the second A, acceptance, and my position regarding my lyrics has changed. They made sense when my assumptions were, one, that humanity and nature are separate, two, that humanity is, quote-unquote, committing crimes against nature, and three, that humanity will be punished for doing so. My thinking now is that, one, I don't see a fundamental distinction between our species and the rest of nature. And two, humanity is behaving exactly in accordance with its evolved genetic imperatives to survive, thrive, and multiply today regardless of the consequences tomorrow. I think my lyrics' vitriolic theme and tone are misplaced, and I suspect the song's effect might possibly be to either foster or reinforce anger and bitterness in listeners. These are natural and appropriate emotions when first waking up to the predicament we are in, as I understand it. But in my personal experience, anger and bitterness are unhelpful and detrimental if not worked through and overcome. The upsides of this new perspective for me are greater compassion and tolerance for my fellows, greater peace of mind, and general happiness. I can only wish the same for others who are going through this. And that is from Aphrazin from about a year ago. All right, Guy, do you want to start with a climate update?
Yes, if we don't have any callers willing to give us a holler at 888-874-4888, I'll jump right into the climate change update. It's astonishing what one can conclude when grid-tied electricity is viewed as a natural right. As pointed out by the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists on February 18, 2016, climate change is accelerating, not slowing, with the construction and use of nuclear power facilities. Mm. James Hansen, take note.
We'll talk about him more later.
And many other people who believe that nuclear is the solution to abrupt climate change. As I've pointed out for at least 5 years now, nuclear facilities, because of the concrete in them, and concrete produces a lot of CO2 in its construction, nuclear facilities don't become carbon negative until they've exceeded their safety date. And now, apparently, according to this evidence from the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, they never get there.
Well, so, nuclear seems to me to be the ultimate negotiation.
Absolutely. Yes, but if we just do this.
Yeah, if we just use this giant thing of poison.
Right.
To power us.
Never mind. As Michael Rupert used to point out, we have never built a human structure that has persisted, 50,000 years, I think he would say.
Right.
And we only need these things to be around for a few million.
Right.
And then we'll be safe. What could possibly go wrong?
Yeah, sure.
Increasing drought threatens almost all forests in the United States, according to a paper in the February 21st, 2016 online issue of Global Change Biology. According to the paper's abstract, quote, "Diebacks, changes in composition and structure, and shifting range limits are widely observed," end quote. I've added this tidbit to feedback number 22. This is a little surprising because everybody thought the eastern deciduous forest was going to be wet forever. Mm. Soil moisture would always be in good shape. It's just the western forests that are threatened. But they did this very large-scale analysis with, I think, 14 authors from all over the country and found out that all forests,
are
essentially, in the United States are screwed.
Yeah.
Absolutely, because of drought.
Yeah.
Who'd have thunk it?
Wow. I'm sure things will turn around soon. Just gotta hope.
In fact, the paper said this might be just a cycle.
Okay.
Just it reminds me of climate change deniers who say that the solar cycles are responsible for ongoing climate change.
Yeah.
It's just a cycle.
We'll pull out of this.
We'll be fine.
Everything's going to be right.
Of course. Well, I mean, for people who look like us.
Right. And if anything bad happens, it won't happen until the end of the century. But if we get started right now, we can change it. Here we go.
Sea level rise is proceeding at the fastest rate in the last 28 centuries.
Yeah, that's a lot of
time. That's not forever,
right?
Which is a long time, especially toward the end.
Yeah.
But 28 centuries, that's still a long time. That's older than you.
Yeah, that's older than Jesus.
Whoo, that's right. And he's been dead for about 2 centuries.
Yeah.
No.
20.
20?
Yeah.
20. Oh, my goodness.
This is 8 centuries before.
This is a long time ago.
Right.
So sea level rise is proceeding at the fastest rate in the last 28 centuries, according to a paper in the February 22nd, 2016 online edition of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And it looks like we have Paul calling in from British Columbia. Mm-hmm. Paul, what you got going?
Oh, I guess I got the wrong phone number. I thought this was the Tucson to Mud Hut shuttle service line.
I'm sorry. It's a small business.
We'll have somebody pick you up right there, Paul.
Oh, good. Well, I'll be expecting that when I get there. Just phoned to say hi, and I was wanting to get your opinions, both of you, on it seems like as the faster-than-expected thing continues, this Arctic ice is probably going to go away this year, but I just wanted to get both of your thoughts on that. And I'll leave the, I'll hang up now, and you guys can have a chat, and we'll see you soon.
Thanks, Paul. We appreciate it.
Okay, bye.
Some of you might remember Paul Marcotte, who has been with us on the show a time or two.
Yeah.
He's always making his next-to-the-last visit here to the Mud Hut. You know, he'll be doing that in about a week or so.
Right, if we get there.
Right, exactly.
I mean, anything can happen.
Anything can happen.
Especially like, with the sea ice.
There's the trip between here and Tucson, for example.
Right.
With me driving. Anything can happen.
That's
true. So I'm scheduled to pick Paul up at the airport in about 10 days. And we'll record next week's show from Tucson.
Mm.
And I'm going to go there a few days early and chat, visit with some people, and do the show from there.
Right.
So what do you think about Arctic sea ice? Is it a good idea? I'd vote for it. It's an election year.
Let me ask a really dumb question that somebody, I don't know, voting might ask. Why would we need Arctic sea ice?
Oh, that's a fun question. Humans have never been on a planet without ice in the Arctic Ocean.
Mm.
Wow. And it's not just albedo. It's not just that white ice reflecting incoming sunlight back into space.
Right.
And instead we have this dark blue ocean that is soaking up the heat. That's not it at all.
Okay.
There's the latent heat of the ice. Once the ice is gone, the energy that is coming from the sun is going to heat up the water much, much faster than it currently is. And let me use an example I sometimes use in my presentations. Say you're walking around at a party and you've got a glass of whatever your favorite beverage is with ice.
Okay.
So not beer.
Right.
But some other beverage with ice. And say it's half ice and half whatever you're drinking at the time. So the whole time there's a little tiny bit of ice there, the temperature of that liquid is 0 degrees Celsius.
Okay.
It's freezing.
Right.
Even with a little tiny sliver of ice, it's still freezing. But once the ice is gone, it starts heating up very rapidly, and it'll reach room temperature in a matter of minutes.
Right.
Okay, so you're walking around, and I did this once at a presentation. I took a glass of ice water. No, really, it was. And for the hour-long presentation and for the half hour afterwards, for the Q&A, it was 0 degrees. It had a little bit of ice.
Right.
But then the ice melts. There's no more buffer from that little bit of ice. So all of the energy that was going into melting ice is now heating up the water. It's a huge difference. For example, the transition from solid water, ice, to liquid water, what we call water,
right,
that transition, once it occurs, it takes approximately 80 calories of energy to melt a gram of ice and turn it into a gram of water or a milliliter of water. 80 calories, incoming calories.
Right.
Okay, so that's quite a bit of energy. Well, once you've melted the ice, all of those 80 calories are going into heating the gram of water. So if it's just a gram, if you have 1 gram of ice and it takes a while to melt and then it becomes water, and it takes 80 calories to convert that 1 gram of ice to 1 gram or 1 milliliter of water. Now that same 80 calories heats it to 80 degrees Celsius.
Okay.
That's scalding hot.
Yeah.
So a little bit of ice really goes a long way.
Right.
So when the ice is gone from the Arctic Ocean, the heating of the ocean there will occur at an exponential pace. And it looks like we're on pace for that to happen this year, although it looked like it was on pace to happen last year as well.
Right.
But based on the data so far, we passed the maximum ice extent in the Arctic about a week ago.
For the season.
For the year.
For the year.
Yeah, for the season, for the year. Generally, that doesn't happen for another month or so.
Okay.
And so it looks like we're already losing total ice extent in the Arctic. And the ice extent now is more than 2 standard deviations from the mean for this time of the year, which means if you don't do stats, that's a lot.
Yeah.
So it's a huge difference. And people warn all the time about when something is 2 standard deviations from the mean, that's pretty serious business.
Right.
and this is very serious business. So last year at this time and after this time, we were approximately 2 standard deviations below the mean as well.
Okay.
And we didn't lose all the ice. In fact, it was only, I believe it was the 4th lowest ice extent on record.
Gotcha.
And records have been kept since 1979. It's still down, way down from 1979. But if we lose the ice this year, it would very much surprise me if we didn't have that 50 gigaton burst of methane come out of the Arctic Ocean that Natalia Shikova says is, quote, highly likely at any time.
Yeah.
So that's a big deal. That alone would warm the planet, global average 1.3 degrees Celsius.
Yeah.
And we're already...
That's not room temperature, folks.
We're already over one.
Yeah.
And, in fact, let's play a little audio from a presentation delivered recently by Kevin Trenberth at the National Center for Atmospheric Research. And he's given this presentation, and he's talking about the global average temperature so far, and this is a very recent presentation because he's talking about events that have just happened that we just have the confirmation of within the last couple of weeks. So give a listen for just a few seconds.
So when you're talking about a jump of 0.2 degree, 0.2 is you know, 20% of the total rise over the entire past century, and that's all happened in this past year.
Yeah, repeat that, would you?
Oh, that's incredible. So 0.2 degree Celsius temperature rise occurred in 2015.
Right.
That's 20% of the total global average temperature rise in the last 100 years.
Wow.
And it happened in a year.
Yeah.
So when we talk about the exponential function, this is the sort of thing we're looking at.
Yeah. It's exponential growth.
So the temperature since baseline, roughly 1750, has increased about 1 degree or 1.2 degrees, mm-hmm, up until 2015. And then in 2015, it increased another 0.2 degrees.
Well, I guess we better start recycling.
I don't think you understand the nature of the predicament.
How about a hybrid car?
I appreciate your bargaining. Okay. Really, I do.
Nuclear? I eat organic.
Let's just negotiate some more. It's working for everybody else.
Free-range chickens?
Yes. Yes. Free-range, organic, GMO-free, no hidden relationships. It's all going to be fine.
Okay. That's good.
Again, we're taking your calls, or you're going to have to put up this banter for the rest of the show.
All right. You want to continue with the climate?
Yeah. The number, again, is 888-874-4888. Last little tidbit on the climate update. I've recently completed a brief analysis of some of the self-reinforcing feedback loops. I just added the effects of the loss of global dimming with the only 2 self-reinforcing feedback loops for which we have an estimate of temperature rise. And I'm going to post this on the blog, guymcpherson.com, tomorrow.
Okay.
At least that's my intent. The bottom line is that we're scheduled for at least a 7 degree Celsius temperature rise that's above where we are right now within a decade or two. That takes us beyond 8 degrees Celsius above baseline, commonly accepted at 1750. The rate would exceed any known global average rise in temperature and brings Earth to a temperature beyond that experienced by any version of human. It takes us to a global average temperature characteristic of the days of the dinosaurs.
Oh. Or 60 million years ago.
Yes. Dinosaur days. Considering our reliance on habitat, this seems a little inconvenient to me. I mean, it's we're already experiencing global average temperature rise faster than has ever been reported in the history of the planet. And this would take us to one of the 2 long-term stable states that Earth has experienced in the last 2 billion years. 2 billion years.
Billions.
And there's really only been 2 stable states. There's Ice Age and there's what I call Jurassic Park or Dinosaur Days.
Right.
And those are the long-term stable states. And there have been relatively rapid transitions between those 2 states in the past, with the most rapid of them when the temperature is rising from Ice Age to Jurassic Park. And so it appears that we're in one of those, and currently the temperature rise is proceeding man, somewhere between 100 and 1,000 times faster than the great dying.
Yeah.
The big extinction event.
The super great dying.
Right, the super great. Super duper awesome.
Super nova fast great dying.
Must go faster. The definition of civilization. So this is a really, really big deal. I never connected these together. I've never added together the effects or the forecast effects of the feedbacks before.
Right.
And I'm only doing that for the two feedbacks that we have estimates of, methane,
right,
atmospheric methane, and moistening of the upper troposphere.
Okay.
So I'm adding those two along with global dimming, which comes from collapse of industrial civilization. And even if you don't think collapse is hovering nearby, then a global average temperature rise associated with either release of methane into the atmosphere or moistening of the upper troposphere will take us there in the short term regardless.
Right.
Because we just can't grow grains at scale in the interior of large continents when we exceed a couple of degrees global average temperature rise.
Right.
It's too warm.
Well, and, you know, we could get the collapse some other ways as well. You know, it could be a pandemic.
Oh, yeah.
Which obviously is related to climate change because of the expansion of, let's say, a carrier like a mosquito.
Yeah. You know, at coffee this morning, our friend Steve brought in a tick that he pulled off his body at Morro Bay, California. And when he was in Oregon a few years ago, he did the same thing. And he took it in, and he told the people in Oregon, I can't remember the town, that he had this deer tick and that he's worried about Lyme.
Yeah.
And they said, no, we don't have Lyme here. There's no need to worry about that.
Right.
And it was Lyme.
Yeah.
And this is climate change.
Right. And this is a while back.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And so he just got his second bullseye, which is the pattern you get when you're bit by a deer tick that's carrying Lyme disease.
Right.
And so he brought the tick in just for all of us to see. And
did
pass
he
vomit
like a deer head?
Well, that was the suggestion.
Hey, you taxidermy the old tick.
So no, he hasn't mounted it yet. He just had it in a Ziploc bag.
Right.
And Jay was a little worried it was going to get away.
Oh.
You know, and bite everybody in
right.
the room. Or no, he wasn't so much worried about that. He was worried about it biting Jay.
Right. Go on a terror.
Right.
All right. You're listening to Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network. Today we're taking calls, 888-874-4888. It's your chance to bring up something. We have Dries from Philly on the line. Dries, you there?
Yes, I am. Hello, fellas. How are you once again?
Great. How you doing?
Good to hear from you. I'm not bad. I'm still breathing right now. Just wanted to, you know, give you guys another shout out and thanks for all the hard work you've been doing. I never miss a show. And just wanted to share something with you in my travels and my conversations, because I'm always trying to keep this type of conversation on the table with my circle of friends. But it seems like every time I try to do so, I'm faced with so much rejection. And for example, the last conversation that I had with a few friends of mine, one of my friends actually got an attitude. I mean, they copped an attitude. They took offense to what I was talking about in reference to, you know, what's going on with the, you know, the climate. I mean, everything. I'm just talking about the whole gamut, not just, you know, what's happening with the environment, with the weather and everything, but just, you know, politics, money, war, crime, all those things, because it's all connected.
Because I'm glad I never get any pushback like that.
I kind of felt like both of you guys, you know, when you talk about, you know, some of the feedback that you get from listeners, from bloggers who, you know, who just come with so much vitriol in their response. And I had a quick question. I just wanted to run something by you just to see if both of you guys already come to this conclusion. But it seems like no one has a clue. Well, the average person seems that they don't have a clue or even want to get a clue about what's happening. And even when it's introduced, just casually in conversation, it seems that, you know, it's always received with such, like, denial. So it kind of ties into, you know, what you talked about earlier in this cast, Mike, in regards to the the stages of grief, you know, the DABDA stages. So and it kind of reinforced what I already kind of learned, which is, and I'll put it out there frankly, denial is a motherfucker. I mean, it really is.
I'm going to quote you on that. That's great.
please do. By all means, quote me on that. But I mean, I'm slowly realizing that day by day. And I mean, it's such a hard barrier to get by. You can't even get to the other stages without, facing the now, of course. And I see that. I mean, I've gone through this myself, but I see it over and over again with the people that I know and the people that I have conversations with. I mean, these are longtime friends of mine, and it's unbelievable. Let me ask you this. I'm kind of rambling a little bit, but how, I guess, and maybe, and I'm really strong, getting serious thought to considering taking that grief counseling class that you taken, Guy. But what kind of tools have either one of you incorporated in your own conversation to try to, I guess, not convince people, but, kind of help people understand, that, but the situation that they're in, as far as getting to the acceptance part of the stages of grief and, tying that into our daily, our situation, out here in life and, dealing with the world.
Yeah, that's an excellent question.
Sense. I don't know if that makes any sense, but
yeah,
okay, thank you. Okay.
It's a good question, and it's a question that I have to consider. Actually, I'm presenting at Arizona State University on Sunday, and it's a conference called the Local to Global Conference, and it's every year is a different theme. This year, the theme is racial justice, and so I'm talking about, obviously, racial injustice, because in order to have racial justice, there needs to be an unjust system in place, and I'm going to talk about civilization, but I'm not going to use those particular terms because people don't know. When I bring that up, I usually get the stare of, I don't know what that even, what do you mean, civilization? That's how we live. And so I tend to talk about it in terms of a narrative. And instead of saying civilization, I talk about the narrative, the collective narrative that we all function under. The underlying narrative. And I think a guest that we had about a month ago, what was Sarah's last name? Sarah Kelly, was it?
I know who you're talking about, the woman who wrote.
Yeah.
Sarah Perry.
Sarah Perry, yes, thank you.
Thank you, that's why we have callers.
Yes, she mentioned about the sacredness of our narratives and how we hold them sacred. And so that's kind of how I approach things and talk about what do we have in common, and that's basically our living arrangement. We are all dependent on large institutions which collectively make up large systems, which collectively make up a massive hierarchy, which is civilization. And you can do that by just talking about it as a cultural story, the story we tell ourselves about ourselves and how we live, which is, we need things to come to us in order to survive. We need food to show up in the stores. We need water to come out of the taps. We need people to build our houses. We need our things imported to us. And that has costs, environmentally and socially. And if we don't think that our social ills are connected to our environmental problems, well, then we're missing a huge portion of the narrative, which is this living arrangement has no future. Because there is no, you can't have infinite growth on a finite planet, and that's really what it comes down to. And the costs are things like racism, patriarchy, climate change, loss of sea ice, loss of species, and so on. So I talk about it as a story because we are a storytelling species, and that seems to at least get me further in the conversation before somebody gets pissed off and walks out of the room, and it's usually a white guy.
And I want to mention something about where we live here in southern New Mexico. Mm-hmm. And my wife and I live in an off-grid house, a straw bale house that we call the mud hut. And Mike and his wife live in a Mongolian ghair or yurt not far from here. And our neighbors, the people we spend time with, are, in my experience anyway, the most non-judgmental group of people I've ever met in my life. And that helps a lot because it reminds me to not judge them either. So when people find things important that I consider trivial, I don't point out to them that they're stupid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I try to act with a little compassion towards people that may not share with me the things that I think are really important. And it's been very influential for me living here, surrounded by this group of people who are non-judgmental. And it doesn't matter whether you're financially rich or monetarily poor. It matters what kind of person you are and how you interact with other people. That's a big deal here, and it's not the kind of experience I enjoyed in the academic arena. So it's quite you can observe a lot just by watching, said Yogi Berra, and and that certainly applies in this case.
Does that answer your question?
Yes, it did. Yes, I mean, it kind of, you know, shed a little bit more light on just my quest to understand human behavior a lot more nowadays than I ever did. So I tend to, you know, adopt that same approach, you know, that non-judgmental approach. It's just I tend to walk away from a lot of those conversations a bit more confused than anything. As not, you know, there's no hate, no vitriol, anything like that. It's just more confusion than anything, because if it kind of makes sense to me when I'm trying to use flawless logic to think about everything that I come across, then I'm assuming, and this is maybe foolish of me, but I'm assuming that, you know, everyone else around me seems to use the same type of logic. So I guess at some point they would come to the same conclusions that, you know, I have, that you all have as well, about what's going on out here. But it just doesn't seem to happen. And so it's just like I'm just, you know, thinking circles around this, thinking laps and laps and laps, and I just can't figure it out. It just doesn't compute. So I mean, it does get a bit frustrating, but more confusing than anything. So
I think the big part of it that I've run into is that we are under the assumption in our narrative that we are a problem-solving species and we can fix anything, and that is one of the foundations of the story we tell ourselves. And to tell people that we face a predicament. We have a word for predicament, and we have a definition, but we don't believe in them. And to tell people that, they can't handle that, because that is so far removed from the story in their heads and the story about this culture, because we've quote-unquote fixed everything. But what we don't realize is that the actual thing that we're living under, civilization, that's the predicament itself. That you can't solve something that creates – its job is to create the problems in the first place. And so I get in these discussions with people, they'll go, well, look at all the great things civilization has done. And usually everything they've brought up is something created by civilization that civilization has gone on to quote-unquote solve.
Right.
So if you're living...
All of our solutions create more problems and more predicaments.
Right. So if your living arrangement is creating the problems and then your living arrangement is quote-unquote solving them, but not really, then you might want to look at the root of where these problems are coming from. But people, they can't see the root. It's like fish in water. They can't see the water because it's just always been there. And it's they've confused living with making a living. They think civilization is life. It is not. It destroys life. And it seems like it's obvious, but when you're born into it and it's all you've ever seen and all you've ever known, I tell you, it took me 40-some years to get there, so...
Well, and bear in mind, too, that we're both teachers. We were both educators for a long time. So we were among the most resistant to the idea, I would say.
Yeah, we were promoting it.
Right.
How to be successful within it.
Right. How to fix every problem. That's my role as an educator.
Right.
Is to tell you how to fix things.
Yeah. And when you tell people that you can't fix this...
Yeah, suddenly you're not really much of a teacher anymore.
No, and you lose a lot of friends.
Yeah, all of them so far, except for four.
Right.
They're here.
All right, Dries, thanks for calling, man.
Sorry, go ahead. Okay, we do have another caller on the line. We have Harvey from Berkeley. Harvey, you still with us?
Yes, I am. I'm enjoying the show today. It's very informative. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for calling in.
Sure. Well, I'd like to talk about the water energy generation nexus there. And this is a really important one. I sort of focus on it. Turns out that all the old fossil fuel, coal-fired, oil-fired, natural gas, and nuclear power plants use as much water or more than agriculture on a daily basis. A lot of it is our freshwater resources. Like here in California, the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant pumps 2.5 billion, with a B, billion gallons of water a day to keep those two nuclear reactors cool, and it dumps it back into the ocean at 20 degrees hotter. But the thing is that I'm looking for, and also the water they use in the mining, drilling, fracking, and as I mentioned, cooling of nuclear plants, is just water intensive. It's the old water boiling technology, and it produces all that CO2 and all that methane that's killing our planet. So, and using up all our water, poisoning our water. I mean, we're just hearing all about that all over the place now. So I'm looking for energy production that uses no water, and it's photovoltaic, light to electricity, thermoelectric, heat to electricity, piezoelectric, pressure to electricity, triboelectric, friction to electricity, and all these can be developed. I believe that it's time to develop these products. None of them, once manufactured and installed, they use no water, like photovoltaics, light to electricity, solar cells. They use no water once manufactured and installed over their 20 to 25 year warranty. And I feel that even that people who put solar panels on the rooftop should get a, what I call a solar water credit for the water they didn't use in the generation of clean, renewable electricity. So we're caught in the fight of our lifetime here, and I think it's time to divest from the old water-using fossil fuel industry and reinvest in the new technology that is here. It's off the shelf and available. And I like to combine those. Like I'll combine photovoltaics, thermoelectrics, and piezoelectrics. So here it is. I call it the Aqua Solar Panel. Instead of a regular glass cover on a solar panel, you have a touch screen. You have a piezoelectric touch screen like you have on computers and all that. And as the raindrops fall on the piezoelectric touch screen, it creates electricity. So, and then it's transparent, and then you have your solar cells underneath that turning light to electricity. But solar cells, because they're gray or black or blue, cobalt blue, they usually heat up, so you have a thermoelectric substrate underneath the solar cells that absorbs the heat and creates additional electricity from the heat that's heating up the solar cell. Plus, it's cooling the solar cell and making it more efficient. So that's the Aqua Solar Panel. But you know, you could have the Sunway, which is the roads, all the roads with a photovoltaic surface, and then you can have thermoelectric devices in the desert. It gets so hot, you use the heat from the road to create energy and piezoelectric.
Harvey, do you have a question?
Well, the question is like, what do you think about moving away from water using our water using generation of electricity toward clean, renewable, non-water using photovoltaics and technology that will save our precious water resources to start with?
Well, I think we're both big fans of doing just about anything different than what we're doing right now. But on the other hand, it's too late to stop the train that not only left the station 40 years ago, but that fell off the trestle a year or two ago. So I'm not sure that we would see any significant benefits at the level of society. But on the other hand, I certainly am not going to ask anybody to do anything or to not pursue something they want to do if it's outside this culture, if it's countercultural.
I think if it's better than what we're doing now, absolutely. And the question I always have is, this shift going to allow us to continue business as usual? Right. If it's to continue business as usual, then all we're doing is replacing one energy source with another energy source to devour the planet.
Right. And this is a major focal point and promotional point of what's called the new economy,
right?
Promoted by the Rockefellers and therefore 350.org and Mark Z. Jacobson at Stanford University, and on and on the list goes. Mm-hmm. This is omnicide by other means.
Right.
Do we want to keep doing that? I haven't been a fan for a long time. We all know, and we've known for many years now, that civilization itself is a heat engine. And not only is it a heat engine, it's the gun that's pointed at the face of nature.
Absolutely. And that's, I think, what we were just talking about with Dries, is people cannot see the actual predicament, which is civilization itself. And so what they do instead is they come up with alternative ways to function within civilization. They never, ever consider dismantling civilization because, one, they don't know it exists. And two, if they get to the point that they know it exists and they can see it, then they come to the quick conclusion that dismantling it means dismantling themselves,
right?
Which means basically their lives. So people want justice, but they don't actually want what it takes, because what it takes is our living arrangement. And if you take this living arrangement, well, then generally you're going to take most of us with it.
Right.
And that is where we are.
In fact, we now know, based on relatively recent information, that that dismantling leads to, almost certainly leads to, loss of habitat for all humans on the planet.
Right.
So it's not just privileged Caucasian people living in the global north,
right,
who will suffer greatly when civilization goes away.
Right.
It's everybody on the planet.
Right. And those who are already suffering from civilization. Right.
Absolutely.
And so we're stuck.
So we're stuck. This is why we call it a predicament.
Which we don't believe in, by the way, for the record.
It reminds me of that Louis C.K. piece. You remember the one, of course, but maybe.
But maybe, right.
Yes. Of course. We got to do this and that and the other thing. But maybe that's what's actually killing us.
Right.
Of course we have to maintain civilization at all costs because that allows us to walk around. But maybe it's civilization itself that is killing everything around us and us too.
Right. Nah.
Nah. You're anti-civ.
Wait. All right. Any more callers, or are we on our own right now?
We're on our own. We are.
Okay, let's talk.
Just making it up as we go along.
Let's talk a little bit about the American Geophysical Union and ExxonMobil.
All right.
Apparently.
Politely, or like we usually do?
Well, apparently, some climate scientists, 100 of them, have written a letter, signed a letter, that is discouraging the American Geophysical Union and their partnership. Funding partnership with ExxonMobil, because obviously ExxonMobil is a fossil fuel company, but ExxonMobil's past has been to put out propaganda to obviously dispute climate change. And they feel that it's confused the general public, and so therefore the American Geophysical Union should not partner up with ExxonMobil. And of course, the American Geophysical Union says, "Well, we'll check in and see what Exxon's up to lately. You know, if they're doing anything bad, to see if we want to continue our relationship." And of course, ExxonMobil had to reply. And here's what they wrote: "We reject the allegations that ExxonMobil suppressed climate change research," a spokesman said in an emailed statement. "This is an inaccurate distortion of ExxonMobil's nearly 40-year history of climate research that was conducted publicly in conjunction with the Department of Energy, academics, and the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change." There's an interesting relationship between those three. We kind of collaborated with them, and we've been working with them. What does that say about those two organizations?
Nothing good.
Right. And so the guys like Michael Mann and the James Hansons of the world, mm-hmm, the people that we've been calling out, mm-hmm, the people that we say are associated with these organizations, institutions.
And we'll continue that trend next week.
Correct.
When we discuss Bill McKibben,
right,
for example.
Are writing a letter now because they're angry.
Angry.
About the relationships the American Geophysical Union has with ExxonMobil.
Right. Which mirrors the relationship they have.
Correct.
With ExxonMobil.
Right.
And have had since the beginning of public broadcasting system. The petroleum broadcasting system.
These are the same guys that are, encouraging the clean coal process and nuclear energy.
Right.
Signing this letter.
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah, again, there's no way out, and it seems to me this is just a distraction and an attempt to take the moral high ground
right.
by people who have already, through their actions, abandoned the moral high ground a generation ago.
Yeah. Well, speaking of which, we have the Breakthrough Energy Coalition, which was started by Bill Gates, and he got together and put together a team of members, including, I believe, Mark Zuckerberg and the guy that is running Netflix and a bunch of others. And they are going to, quote unquote, change energy use in the world.
So let me get this straight. These are a bunch of people who look a lot like us,
but with a lot more money and a larger footprint.
And who are trying to hold on to this set of living arrangements.
Just clawing.
For as long as humanly possible. Well, and when I say humanly, I mean white men.
Right.
Possible.
Well, Marketplace interviewed Gates regarding this, and I only have to read the first question and answer, and you know where this is. So, Marketplace question. Regarding electric power, energy, what is the market failure here that you and some other wealthy individuals are trying to fix? Bill Gates responds, we need clean energy that's incredibly reliable, and most of the renewables we have are intermittent. Being able to store that energy or having some new source that runs 24 hours a day, that's what we need to solve the climate problem.
Wait a minute. That's what created this climate predicament.
But these guys are really smart.
And
that's why they're rich.
Oh, I'm sure this will fix it then. Oh, all right. We have Barbara from South Carolina. Barbara, are you still with us?
Yes, it's not South Carolina, it's South Virginia. Hi.
Hi.
Well, it's almost the same thing.
Did you say South Virginia?
Because that's not a state.
That's not a state.
Just so you know.
Southeast.
Okay, if you haven't left because you're insulted by us, go ahead and say whatever you're going to say.
I'm insulted by you. I love you. Love your humor and your facetiousness with each other.
No, we actually don't like each other. That's real.
That's
what
like
you got, Barbara?
We don't love each other, right?
Right.
I've gotten to another stage of acceptance and that whole process, and it's the stage of I can't. I just can't anymore. I don't have patience with listening to the election and the people.
Candidates.
They're ignorant. They're terrible. And when Bill Gates and Paul Beckwith and Hansen come up with these non-logical solutions just to perpetuate their own agenda, is that I can't listen to this anymore. It's just people are in such a state of mind to try to continue to have their own, you know, their own agenda working.
Yeah. It's insanity, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. And it has been.
I'm not sure how we can help. We're only on the air an hour a week.
Oh, this is the best hour of the week.
That being said, who are you voting for?
you should run for election.
No.
Right.
Yeah, right.
No. Who was it said they wouldn't be a member of any club that would have them? That's us.
That's us.
All right. Well, I just called. The other thing I was asking about is the Baltic Dry Index. Why do you think, do you have any thoughts about why ships are all in port?
Yeah, because we're in the midst of a worldwide Great Depression that by many metrics is more severe than what we called the Great Depression in the 1920s and 1930s in the world. Yeah. And so there's nobody shipping anything because nobody's buying anything. And if nobody's buying that cheap plastic crap in China, there's no reason to put on a ship.
Well, oil is what, $29 a barrel?
Yeah, and it could go to 20, it could go to 10.
Right.
Because there's no demand.
Dare I say, this seems to be trending, because even Tom Hartman has put out a book this year about the impending collapse of 2016. And I wouldn't exactly call Tom a doomer.
No. Although he wrote the Last Rays of Ancient Sunshine.
Yeah,
then
he didn't talk about peak oil for 10 years.
Right, exactly. So he used to write about that.
Right, but then he wanted a job.
Then he got on the air. And he doesn't talk about certain things anymore.
Yeah.
Aside from the economics of it, I was wondering about the oceans. Like Beckwith was saying, that there's going to be high seas when the water temperatures equalize, and there's going to be more severe waves. So is shipping stopped because the height of the waves? Do you follow me?
Yeah. So sea level rise is, and there's also places in the world where the sea level is falling right now. But I think what you're pointing out is that when it all equilibrates, when the glaciers going into the ocean have contributed to sea level rise, when it all equilibrates, there will be a couple of factors. One, the global sea level will rise, and it will rise more in some places than others. But that's not really the big issue. Two, the big issue is a relatively small increase in sea level rise locally means the storm surge associated with that area is going to be unbelievable. So, you know, in Miami Beach, which is a relatively wealthy community, there are now building codes that require houses. Apparently, I'm getting this information secondhand. Apparently, houses are required to be built with vaulted ceilings so that somebody can come in and pour concrete at the floor and raise up the floor level 3 feet the future.
They were doing that actually already in the National Geographic program you were in.
That's unbelievably ridiculous, because when sea level rise is 3 feet, you think Sandy was a problem with 4 inches of sea level rise?
Vaulted ceilings can solve a lot of issues. It opens up the space.
Yeah, the vaulted ceiling, talk about open space. That ceiling's going to be ripped off of every one of those houses. And then you're going to have open space.
Well, you're an alarmist.
Well, certainly the situation is alarming.
Any other comments you got, Barbara?
No, thank you. Have
okay,
a good
thanks.
Time.
Thanks for hanging with us.
So we have, what, a few minutes left, don't we?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
We have probably 3 or 4 minutes.
Apparently, they sealed the leak at Porter Ranch in California.
Yeah, that's...
Permanently.
Permanently. Apparently, Buddhism isn't in flavor anymore. Impermanent. Yeah. All is impermanent.
Right.
I seem to remember that from somewhere.
I did read an article, several articles that were similar on various websites talking about that. Obviously, this was the big leak, but there are various leaks and spills all over the globe, and particularly the United States, because of our declining infrastructure and really the lack of service to those infrastructures, the infrastructure and the amount of people going around and making sure that things are up to code and so on and so forth. So we are crumbling in some aspects and have been for a long time, because we even hear it in the mainstream media, they're aware of our crumbling infrastructure, everything from bridges, roads, and apparently wells as well.
Right. Yes.
So we got that.
I just came across something. Somebody just sent me this link. And it's an interview between Chris Hedges and Jill Stein. So Chris Hedges is interviewing presidential candidate from the Green Party, Jill Stein. And here's her response to one of his questions.
Jill Stein, who apparently runs every election cycle now.
Apparently.
after Ralph Nader was gone. Right. And Jill Stein since, I think.
So. So she says, because if you don't go into the fight, you know the price that you're going to pay. You know, we're facing extinction right now as a biosphere. We are undergoing extinction that we will not survive.
That's not a good platform, by the way, to get elected.
You think? And this is from a few days ago.
No. Okay.
So Jill Stein says, we are undergoing extinction that we will not survive.
Right. Vote for me.
You know, there is no going forward here. We are at the edge of the cliff, and we need to push back, and that is utterly clear. So, and then she says, the clock is ticking. It's now or never, folks, you know.
The clock is ticking. Jill Stein, 2016.
Well, I appreciate
I do too.
That she admits it.
Yeah.
The clock is ticking. We need to push back, and she also points out that that won't help.
Right.
That we're dead anyway.
Why should I vote for her?
Because as Chris Hedges, who is conducting the interview, says,
yeah.
as Chris Hedges says, I don't fight fascism because I win. I fight fascism because it's fascism.
Okay.
I don't fight fascists because I win. I fight fascists because they're fascists. So, and I think that's the approach she's taking based on the those three lines I read from this extensive interview.
Okay.
That we need to push back because it's an indication of our moral courage.
Right. We need to push back, but I don't know if we need I mean, if you're running for an office, if you're running for a living arrangement and you want to run it, are you going to get in power and just dismantle it?
Well, right.
You think you'd be a revolutionary at this point and not run for office.
Right. And maybe riding your motorcycle with a shotgun at your side,
right.
Shea style, instead of running for office and promoting keeping the system going.
No.
Yeah, maybe.
All right. Is that it? That's it. All right, folks. That about wraps it up this week. Make sure to like us on Facebook page, Nature Bats Last, on the Progressive Radio Network. You can join our Facebook group as well. It's Nature Bats Last on PRN.FM. And feel free to post questions you'd like us to address on the show. And please share our link on as many pages as you can that relate to our show. Please continue to follow Guy's blog at GuyMcPherson.com for further updates, essays, and speaking tours. Thank you, listening audience, live studio audience. We see you on the radio next Tuesday afternoon, 3 p.m. Eastern. We'll be taking your calls. We'll be responding to your comments and questions. It's a call-out show focused on the work of Bill McKibben, and Corey Morningstar will be joining us as well. If you missed the show, make sure to find us on the archives at PRN or at Stitcher.com and rate us on iTunes. Thanks again to our listeners, especially those who called in, and also to Afrazin for his music. Until next time, remember, as Dree says, denial is a motherfucker. The dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end,
nature bats last.
Mother Nature, Mother Nature.